Blog Talk Radio.
And here we are back on another Monday night. This is John and Jeff with Beyond the Cover. Jeff, how you doing, man?
Doing fantastic.
And tonight we have a very special guest calling us all the way from, well, I don't want to tell you where he's calling from because you might not want people to know where he's calling from. But it's best-selling author and scare master Kevin O'Brien is on the phone with us. And after that, in the second half, we're going to play another clip from our Thriller Fest interview. And tonight we will have Scott Chereau. So let's hit it now with our guest. And here he is, the author of his latest book out, No One Needs to Know, another book that will scare the hell out of you, Kevin O'Brien. Thanks so much for coming on. How you doing?
John, Jeff, it is great to be here on Beyond the Cover. It is so terrific. And you know what? I didn't know that I'm being followed by Scott Chereau. We are both New Trier graduates, New Trier High School in Winnetka, Illinois. So put that in your pipe.
Really?
And smoke it. Yeah. It's known for a lot of celebrities that ended up coming from there. Rock Hudson, Charlton Heston, Anne Margaret. I had the same vocal teacher as Anne Margaret. It didn't get me anywhere.
Wow.
But we were, I'm wrong about Paul Prentice, but another big shot. Bruce Dern is another one of the people who came from.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of
it's like a little. Like a little hotbed of celebrity
action
going on there. Yeah,
and Mr. Chereau is the other New Trier graduate. I think he was, I'd like to say we're about the same years, I think, but we missed each other by a few years. So.
Yeah. Well, you guys are both young. I mean,
we're just young whippersnappers. What can I tell you? Yeah.
I thought I was. Well, let's get into the book here right now. So No One Needs to Know is your latest one, and it's out now. So why don't you go ahead and give everybody the synopsis, the behind-the-scenes look into what you've done this time and how many people you've killed and the brutal ways you've done it.
And how many I've matched in that, just how, yes. I'm
right.
You can picture me wringing my hands like, yes, you know, tweaking my mustache and everything else as I'm talking about this. Well, the book is called No One Needs to Know, which has been a challenge whenever anybody asks me, what's the title of your new book? And I always say, No One Needs to Know. And they're like, well, really, I'd like to know what the title is of your new book. And so it's a little confusing. But this story is about, I was influenced by, in Cold Blood, I had read that they filmed the movie of Truman Capote's book in the actual locations, including the house where the Clutters were killed. And that just sort of sent chills up my spine. And I thought, what if they were doing this in a fictional murder? I could write something where there's a fictional murder and they are filming at the actual locales. And I'd also read about the different curses and problems and creepy hauntings that went on when they were shooting The Exorcist. And I thought, well, let's combine the two. And then I threw in the Sharon Tate murders, and we had a book. It's the book about a movie star who was murdered in Seattle in 1970, and it's now present day. And my heroine is working for a catering company that's catering the movie, and she's also on the run from a stalker. There's never only one storyline going on in my books. There's always a thousand things going on. And different people start dying who are connected with this movie, and she starts to put together a certain connection between what's going on now and what went on in 1970. So it's kind of a very creepy, menacing, and yet there's a little bit of 1970s nostalgia in there too. So I had a good time writing this. I creeped myself out writing this. So that's always a good sign. That's always a sign. If I creep myself out, I scare myself, then I think I'm on the right direction.
Well, I'm going to ask you about that in another minute, about another time that happened to you.
because it's
oh, you
an
know
awesome
about
story,
that, don't you?
It's true, yes. So I have to say, love the book. There's this wonderful scene where there's an explosion, and you almost took out my day job. Almost. So thank you by that.
I love it.
What
I can do to shake up your life?
Right.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So I was wondering about how do you research your work? I could say what the hell is wrong with you, but I'll just ask. Talk a bit about research.
Well, for this one, I did a little on the Sharon Tate murders, which was very disturbing to do. I didn't enjoy this research because, not to put ideas into people's head, but if you Google Sharon Tate, you're going to get pictures that you don't want to see, and it's a little too grisly. So
I'm doing that right now.
I know you sick pup, you. You just can't take the boy out of high school, but you can't take the high school out of the boy. You just
nope.
Got to go and check it out. No, we all have a little slightly morbid, thing, and then we're sorry we did it. Oh, geez, why did I look that up? But so there was a little research there. I also, I did locale research a lot. I always do locale research a lot. And I used to work for the railroads, and my job took me all over the Pacific Northwest. And one of my pass-through cities was Ellensburg. So I made my heroine from Ellensburg, but I hadn't been there in years, so I had to do some research on what was new in Ellensburg so I didn't get the details wrong. And, I love setting my stuff in Seattle, so, I had to look up some areas that I didn't know, and I had a great time. So I love doing my research most of the time, but, sometimes when I'm actually looking up true murder cases, it creeps me out. So, especially since I do a lot of my writing and researching late at night on the computer, and that's a time where you're feeling the most vulnerable or the most morbid or whatever. Your psyche is in a different place, I think.
Well, mm-hmm. You mentioned you had a day job at one time. When did you feel comfortable enough to give that up?
Well, I moved out to Seattle in 1980 working for the railroads, and I was a railroad inspector, like I say. And in 1986, I sold my first book the day after my 30th birthday. And I thought I was going to, be able to quit my railroad job. I thought, I'd be on the cover of the Seattle Times. I thought it was like, when are the celebrities going to, be calling me up? And I talked to Terry Brooks, who I got introduced to from a bookseller. In fact, the bookseller was his wife, Judine. And she got us together, and he told me, he said, I hear you thinking of quitting your day job. Well, he said, wait until you've at least earned at least 2 years worth to live on off of your writing until you quit. He said, because, you have to have a cushion. You don't want to just quit and think you're going to get by. And so I held in there for, till 1997. And I had a book called Only Son. It was my second book. And we had a movie deal with it. Tom Hanks was interested for a while, and in fact, when we first got film interest, they wouldn't tell us who the film star who was interested in it was, and so I had friends calling me up going, this is Eric Estrada, I'm the person who's interested in your,
right.
Interested in your, oh, Eric, you're making a comeback, I'm so glad you're doing it with my book. Anyway, so Tom Hanks was briefly interested in it, and of course my head was so swelled up so high, I was so full of myself when that happened, because he was red hot after Philadelphia and Forrest Gump had just come out at this time, so he was like a household name, not what he is now, but mm-hmm. So we got some money on that, and then Reader's Digest picked up Only Sons, and in not only the regular Reader's Digest, but all of the world. So I made a little chunk of change on that, and it was just enough of a nest egg to take a buyout. The perfect timing. The railroads offered me a buyout. I was like, yes, I'll take it. And so I got a little extra money from the railroads and was able to have a cushy, a nice separation in 1997. I haven't looked back. So it's been great. To be doing what you want to do and making a living at it, it's just a dream come true.
That's cool.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing, though, that you've been able to not fall in love with, because
Jeff and I had this conversation on the radio a couple months ago, maybe, and we had talked about series compared to standalones. And I said that I'm a more of a standalone guy than a series. Because unless I know the series is ending, like it's a 3-book trilogy or 5-book series, then I'm okay.
On the money. But, yes.
Yeah, but the ones that keep going on and on, I get very bored with, and so I'm a standalone guy. Is that the reason, and what is the reason why you have fallen into writing a series?
Well, that's one of them. There's a couple of ongoing things, and one of them is that I love stories where person is like an amateur detective. They're not a professional. It's not some forensics expert. It's not a ballistics expert. And, you know, it's always some, in my case, it's some teacher, you know, or another case, it was a nurse. This new one, she's a caterer. You know, it's some amateur who has to rise to the occasion to solve a series of murders and who's in danger. And I always feel that raises the danger level if they're not, you know, if they're not a pro. And, you know, throw in a kid. If they have a kid and they're alone, geez, that, you know, a single mom, that's the most vulnerable, because she's worried about the mom. And so the reader can worry about her. And so it's great to work that, you know, that suspense level in there. So, you know, if you have this teacher who keeps solving murder after murder, book after book, you're like, what the hell's going on in that school? You know, what's in that school district? What's going on? So it doesn't make any sense. And I like reinventing characters or to come up with new people each time in a new situation and a new city. It's almost always Seattle, but, sometimes it's Portland. Sometimes it'll begin someplace else. So I like that challenge. The other thing I don't really like about sequels is what I think you've heard me call it, say this, Jeff, is the Pussy Galore syndrome. What happened to Pussy Galore after, you know, after Goldfinger? You think they were going to get married? No, she just disappears. And, you know, I hate to see characters suddenly disappear. And, you know, Bob Degoni, a mutual friend of ours, he was saying when he had a series, they told him, they said, well, you're going to kill the wife, aren't you? You know, for the next thing, because we want him single. You know, so there's certain kids, he was like, I like the wife. I hated to see her go. But, you know, you're sort of, you have to keep things fresh each time with the same character. So, you know, you have to shift things around. So, you know, I don't think I'll probably ever do a sequel. I don't want to say, you know, definitely not, but, in fact, my brother-in-law was just reading one of my books, and he's like, I see you can do a sequel here. It's like, oh, really? Okay.
Oh, God.
See, yeah, watch me have a sequel next year. It's like, that guy is so full of it. I don't know what he's talking about.
That's all right. Stephen King lied about when he had the Dark Tower series done, so you can lie, too.
Right.
I'm starting to sing. I've been working on the railroad, by the way. I just wanted to let you know.
Yeah, oh, good.
That's okay, because I'm looking at Sharon Tate murder pictures, so go ahead.
Oh, are you?
Okay, great. Yeah, happy everybody.
Morbid group.
So I'd like to talk a bit about violence in your novels, because you don't go overboard with the gore. It's more the suspense and things like a Hitchcock. And I'm wondering, how do you sort of tone the violence and also avoid the serial killer cliches?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I like the build up. You know, it's always the foreplay to a murder is always the most suspenseful part of it. And you know, it's I think that's the part that really creep people out. And it's when you leave stuff to their imagination that it can really hit home, rather than just talk about every slice and every stab. It's much more interesting if you fade out at a certain point, and then, the discovery of a dead body is always kind of creepy and unsettling. So I'd rather have that than just, you know, the bloodletting and the gore. It's I find it kind of boring after a while. It's, you know,
yep.
It gets too precise or some too scientific, you know, if you're talking about all that bloodletting. You know, all you do is have to, you know, take it up to a point, and it's creepy, you know. If you just work it up to that point, I remember one of the first, you know, Hitchcock said, I write my murder scenes like love scenes and my love scenes like murder scenes. And, you know, which is kind of perverse. But, you know, I learned that on my very first book, the very first sex scene I wrote. I took it up to a point. It was this boy helping this cougar on her husband's yacht, and they were alone, and she's doing everything she can to sex him up a lot. And I sound really educated, to sex him up a lot. And I take it right up to the
you
point.
You sexy where, beast.
Yes, exactly, where he finally, yeah. You know, starts to make out with her, and she just says something like, oh, do it, or something. My last line was, he was obedient, or something like that. And everybody read that scene, it's a hot scene. I was like, well, you didn't even, you know, I didn't even get their clothes off. It was just, it was the buildup. And that taught me, mm-hmm. It taught me, you know, that it's the buildup to a scene that causes the suspense and gets your heart racing. You don't have to go into all the scientific mumbo jumbo about either bloodletting or sex parts or whatever it's going to be. So as long as you built it up to a good point, you can walk off and let them imagine.
I mean, seeing as how we're all men, I mean, we've all not made it to the bed. Am I right? At certain times, and it's like, you know, it's happened. So
this
okay
is a nighttime broadcast. I forgot. This
it
is
so yes,
TMI, you know, people. I'm just saying.
Yes. I didn't say why, but yeah, I mean, come on. If you're under 18 listening to this, I don't know why the fuck you do it.
I don't know.
But
as long as we're talking about this, for my first
Jeff, few, you better tell your daughter not to listen to this episode.
Listen,
go ahead.
Don't listen. So the first few sex scenes that I wrote, I was consulting Penthouse magazines, letters to Penthouse. It was.
Oh, I love Penthouse letters.
Yes. That's how I got influenced by my first sex scenes that I wrote for my very first book, which was full of sex scenes. Anyway, I cut you off. I'm rude as hell.
No. But see, what I was going to say, because I like what Jeff, because I am, horror is my favorite genre. I mean, mm-hmm. and you're borderline horror thriller. I mean, you can put yourself
right
in the horror, but I don't like gore. And I always say that Halloween is my favorite horror movie. There was no blood in that movie. Zero
you're
blood
right
at
you're right
all.
You think of it
and
as
so,
extremely
but people
violent.
People don't realize that. Right, because the whole build-up was, it was the music, it was knowing what was coming, it was all the things. And the first half of the book that, you know, no one needs to know that you wrote, and that is the title, but the first half of the book, I mean, literally could have almost been a book on its own, just how you did it. And then all of a sudden, then you switch it, and then you kind of have all that kind of going forward, and then you have it moving on forward. But I mean, it's almost a sequel within the sequel of the book. It's kind of how it's written.
Yeah.
And I find that absolutely fascinating.
Oh,
and I loved
thank
it.
You.
And
thank
like
you.
I said, off the air, and I will say it on the air. First of all, Kevin O'Brien is the best horror writer in the business right now. Hands
oh
down, there's no one even close.
Your
second,
check is in the mail.
No, there's no one even close. And the book that I was writing, I literally stopped after reading this and said, you know what? My ending, my beginning is not good enough. And I said, I have to change it based on how you wrote. And that is for sure. And then I went back and got terrified. Well, that was because it was on sale for 99 cents. But I would have bought it full price anyway. But it was on sale for 99 cents that time. But and so I just wanted to say, and that's the thing that I think that you did such a wonderful job of in this book. And so now that I actually come to my question, what's the best killing scene you've done in any of your novels that you look back and say, the one that literally scared the shit out of me that I'll never forget that I wrote down?
Oh, jeez, that's a good one. Oh God, I could get started on any of them. Let's see. One of them was, and I'm trying to remember which book this was. God. Well, I think I've told the one about Vicious, where it was the buildup. It was, you knew this guy was going to kill this woman, and she, you know, he's going to tinker with her car, a little bit of what, you know, Ted Bundy really did. He's tinkering with her car, and while she's stopped off at a mom and pop grocery store in the woods someplace, and she's going to be driving on the lonely highway, and the car starts to break down. Sure enough, she's got her her soda. She's got her Diet Coke and her barbecue potato chips she's nibbling on, and the car breaks down, and it's starting to rain, and it's, you know, dark and rainy, and there's no one else on the road, and of course her cell phone doesn't work, and she looks in the rearview mirror, and around the corner comes this pair of headlights, and she's relieved, and of course I'm hoping the reader is going, God, you know, hide, do whatever you want. And then I just cut to the local sheriff finds the car with the doors open and lights burned out, and there's a raccoon eating barbecue potato chips in the empty front seat. And that kind of suggestion that something really creepy went on, you don't really know, but that's all you need to see, you know? And I think that was one of the creepiest ones I've done. I've run out of ways to kill people, in fact. It's very challenging. And no one needs to know one of my favorite murders in that. Doesn't that sound gruesome? One of my favorite murders.
Yeah, one of my favorite murders.
And she was kind of an obnoxious character anyway, is this Hollywood reporter is thrown down a flight of stairs in Seattle. That's the Denny Blaine stairs that are 360 steps. So she's thrown down there, and she's rather old woman, so I was talking about the brittle bones that hit the first step, and I didn't go on beyond that. I didn't, you know, I just said
you could hear the cracking in that scene. You could hear the cracking.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You could.
Thank you. I got it, huh?
I got a torture one, though, that I thought of, and this is for my ex-wife, is to do a bunch of paper cuts and then to dip her in salt water and just listen to her scream.
You are just a sadist. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Just writing that down right now.
I won't see the love. In the book I'm writing right now, there is somebody, somebody's doing a turnaround. So on all the kids who were bullying him in school, and one girl spread a rumor that he liked to cut himself. And so this girl, when she's killed, she's got a zillion little cuts on her body when they find her, because, you know, he's getting even with her. And you just gave me an idea. I might have to put some salt on those wounds, but I can't do it now. It's got your copyright on it, so I'm gonna have to.
No, you can use anything you want. Are you kidding
me?
To do that? I mean, I'm a weird person. I think of weird shit, and I do it a lot of times on the bathroom, and I don't know why it comes to me there. But that's just what happens. And I think of these things. I go, God, what if you paper cut somebody and then you just kind of dipped them in salt water and just listened to them scream? Would that work
juice.
To get them to talk?
Yeah, lemon juice. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. Just something. Just a little scream.
Did you ever
and
see
then
that?
I put my ex-wife's face on that person's body, and that all makes sense.
Oh, well, that's what I do with Amazon reviewers. If they're nasty to me, I look up their names and sort of switch their names around a little and kill them off. And, you know, they're always like, I'm never going to read one of his books again. So I'm like, good, I'll kill you in the next
good.
One.
Good, yeah. Fuck, you ain't reading any book no more.
Yeah, right. Fortunately,
I'm so thankful we like your works. I'm just saying.
I did tell somebody, though, I was with you, Jeff, and I sat there and I go, if you really want to die in one of Kevin's books, just go on Amazon and write a really shitty review, and it'll kill you.
Exactly. Write a nice review. I'll get you.
Who needs an auction?
You know.
I love it.
Yeah,
when my sister's was working with somebody she couldn't stand, and so I named some character after her and really made the woman a total biatch, and all sorts of awful things happened before she was thrown out a window. So my sister was very happy to see her, this nasty coworker, get treated as well as she did.
Very therapeutic.
Kevin, you've got to tell the story about the night you scared yourself, because
this is classic.
You got to do it, man.
I'm such a spaz. Well, I was writing, in fact, the scene I was just mentioning.
I have an idea for it, too. Hold on. Here we go. You ready? Go ahead. Now tell the story.
Go for it. Oh. One night, when I was writing one very scary scene, and I was alone in the house. Are you still playing the Halloween music? I can't.
No, I'm not. I stopped it because you were going to town. So go ahead.
You figured if I kept talking at this, we'll still be on here for another 45 minutes listening to and tell this damn story.
You're fine with me.
No, I was writing the same story, the same scene that I was just describing with this woman on the lonely highway, and I kind of creeped myself out. I got, you know, the little pinprick feeling on the back of your neck and everything else. And it was like around 1 o'clock in the morning, and I got up to get my slang dictionary, which was in another part of the house, and I saw the front door was open, and it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, so I freaked out, and I ran into the kitchen and grabbed the first thing I could, which was a meat tenderizer, and as I was telling the story to somebody, they were like, "You grabbed Lori's seasoning salt? What are you talking about?" And I was like, "No, I grabbed one of those mallets, you know, that they pound the meat with." So, and no jokes on the pounding the meat. Anyway, I grabbed the.
We already did that by not making it to the bed.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you very much. Our sponsors just withdrew.
Speaking of our sponsors, New American Light. No, go ahead.
That's right. We were brought to you by Lori's Seasoning Salt. Anyway, yeah. Now, I ran around the apartment with this mallet looking for, you know, checking behind the drapes and in the closets and everything else just to make sure I was fine. And then I told this to an interviewer, and some snarky guy with the Seattle Stranger, you know, our free press in Seattle, our hipster free press, reviewed, I think it was Vicious that I was writing at the time. He said, this author scares himself so much he runs around the house with kitchen utensils to make sure he's safe. But it happened.
Did you ever find what the noise was? Did you ever find out what the noise was?
No. I think I just left the stupid door open by mistake, and it just yawned open, and, I just was a little freaked out, you know. So it's really weird. And sometimes it's the opposite. I'm so tired that I don't even take normal precautions. I actually took a shower at, like, 1 o'clock in the morning with the door open a crack. You know, I was just so preoccupied with. And me in the shower, I mean, since I was a kid, I had to, you know, I have to have everything bolted if I'm going to take a shower because of psycho. So the fact that I was so haggard by a deadline that I was, you know, that distracted that I'd take a shower without locking up the door and bolting it. Mm-hmm. So I'm as big as I am scaring people.
No, I mean, when I was like 10 years old, my sister she went to college and my mom worked late. And so sometimes I was home alone in my apartment, and I would refuse to go upstairs to my bedroom. I would refuse. And, of course, I was 8 years old when I saw Halloween. Yeah. I was 9 years old when I saw Amityville Horror. I had to see him in the movie theater. My sister dragged me because she had to go, and I had to go, too. So I was freaking petrified. And then I saw Salem's Lot, and then I started loving horror movies, but I still wouldn't go upstairs in my bedroom in the dark. There's no way in hell
no,
I was doing
that.
No, you scare
yourself silly, yeah. And then you can't sleep. You don't want to go anyplace, but you come back for more. Isn't that the truth?
Yep.
Wow. Well, along similar notes here, we've talked about No One Needs to Know. We've talked about Vicious. I got to ask, what's with the titles? Who comes up with these titles?
Well, my editor,
No One Needs to Know.
No.
It says it all.
Exactly.
And don't tell me you're sorry.
Right.
No, it's my editor who comes up with all these titles. I haven't titled any of my books since Only Son, which is going back to 96. So since 1999, it's all been my editor or the publisher deciding what to call the books, which is great. It takes a lot of the heat off me for coming up with these titles. But, you know, as I've pointed out several times when I'm talking about the book title, I can't keep track of them. And he started out with a rhyming pattern. It was the first thriller I had was called The Next to Die. Then it was Make Them Cry. Then it was Watch Them Die. and I said, I should do a cookbook called Eat a Pie or something.
Yeah.
Dating book called Meet a Guy, you know, and he threw a fast one on me. He the next one he called was Left for Dead, and then he went into a final thing. It went to Final Breath, One Last Scream, The Last Victim, and just when I was getting used to those, he switched on me and said, well, the next book is just going to be one word. And I was like, oh, okay. And I think it was between two, and he came up with Vicious. And so the cover, it was very very funny. They put Vicious between my first and last name. So it was Kevin Vicious O'Brien. Looked like it was my middle name. So it was pretty funny. And then it was Kevin O'Brien Disturbed.
Yep.
Kevin O'Brien.
And then
Terrified.
Unspeakable.
Yes.
And then Unspeakable. Terrified. Yeah.
Yes. And Unspeakable, ironically enough, was my first book to go to audio. You figure that one out. So, yeah. And then
okay, there's no pun there, is there?
There's no pun.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then when I was thinking, was just getting used to the one-word titles, and he came up with Tell Me You're Sorry. And that was followed by No One Needs to Know. And I think he's already got a title for my next book that I'm writing right now. So I think, I don't know if I should say it. The people at Suspense Magazine should be the first people to hear it. So you heard it here first on Beyond the Cover. And that is, the new title is going to be, I'm just spacing out on it. It's called You'll Miss Me When I'm Gone. How about that?
Oh, I thought you were literally leaving some suspense for the hell of it.
No,
I'm
I had a senior moment. I had a senior moment. I think I'm.
So you've gone from one word. Okay, so you've gone from rhyming to final to one word.
One word.
To now several words.
Several words, yeah. They won't be able to fit my name on the cover anymore. You know, it's going to be, you know, it's a mad. There are worlds. Yeah.
It's just going to say KO.
KO.
We are going to kill a bunch of people in this book.
Always more mutant, more carnage than ever before. No. I try and keep the body count down.
So we always have like a yellow, you know, we have a lot of authors that listen to the show because, and a lot of aspiring authors because people want to be where you are and they want to do this full time and that's what they want to be. So what kind of advice did you get early on that you kind of carry with you, and then when people ask you, you kind of, you know, let them know, and hopefully it helps them?
One is get into a writer's class. Take a class or get into a writer's group. Get with a group of people who can be supportive, because writing is a very lonely profession. And you can share ideas. You can share. If you're trying to get published, it's really good to be with a group, because somebody always is in the know. Let's go check out the Pacific Northwest Writers Association. Let's go check out this author's going to be in town. Let's check him out. So you always have some connection. You feel connected to your writing through other people that way. But the other thing I always tell people is, don't get discouraged. Rejection's part of the business, and don't be so full of yourself that you aren't going to be willing to listen to what people say about your book. That you're working on, listen to feedback, take that into account, but at the same time have enough confidence to keep moving forward, to stick with what you want to do and to follow your dream. Like I say, I got published the day after my 30th birthday, and my goal had been to get published by the time I was 30. So I'm glad I didn't give up on that goal. So don't give up on your goal. It's one of those that's probably a very, very long-winded answer to your question, but there it is.
No, that's good, though. And now, the other thing is, we just had somebody ask us a question. They want to know, what is the Seattle 7?
The Seattle 7 was started by Garth Stein and Jenny Shortridge, and they are two terrific authors. You've probably heard of both of them. And they had started out, they got to know each other, and they different other authors got in on it, and they would just get together with what they called wine and wine. they'd whine about their writing, and then they'd have some wine. And after a while, they eventually said, let's do some good with the number of authors that are here. And so they promote literacy. They raise money and collect books for food shelters and homeless shelters and halfway houses. And we've already given at least 25,000, I think, books to homeless shelters and to halfway houses and food bank places, at the same time raise money to promote literacy and reading and writing in schools. So it's a great group. And started out as 7 people, and it's now 77, and we have some wonderful.
And if people want to get in, if people want to get involved, like myself, how would you do that?
Oh, you could always volunteer at one of our events. We have a holiday book signing in November. We have a Right Here, Right Now session that's every, I think, January. We have another one coming up on Bainbridge Island in next month. You can volunteer and you get to know some of these authors. It's great. So I think we're capping off as far as membership at 77 for a while because we figured that was a good round number. And so
I'm in the core group,
but which is about seven people, and then we have another 70 friends, which include people like Tom Robbins and Eric Larson and Susan Wiggs and just some wonderful people. And Robert Schenken, don't get me started on the group. I mean, there's so many wonderful people involved in the
awesome.
Seattle.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, so now I have this image of Jenny Shortridge and Garth Stein getting to know each other, so thank you for that, by the way.
There's various spouses are going to be a little alarmed, aren't they?
Yes. Have you ever, we've talked about how much we love your writing, but I'm just wondering, have you ever had the urge to write something completely different?
That's a great question. My first two books were very different from thrillers. My first book was called Actors, and that's the one that had all the sex scenes in it. And it was a sweeping saga about star-crossed lovers trying to make it, you know, big in Hollywood. And the next one was a kidnapping story that didn't have, that had a lot of suspense in it, but was mostly a, what you'd, you know, call literary fiction. It was a general fiction. So when I started in writing thrillers in 1999, with the Next to Die being my first one, it was pretty successful. And I think right after that, I was talking to my agent. I said, you know, could I maybe write another book like Only Son that's not got, you know, people aren't going to wait for, you know, why didn't somebody die in the first chapter? Why wasn't somebody killed? You know, and she said, no. She said, you found a niche, you're good at it. Why don't you, you know, stick with it and be happy? I got to go along with that. If I'm going to be stuck in any kind of writing in any kind of genre, that's the one I'd like to be stuck in. It's, you know, most of my thrillers have pretty in-depth characters, I hope at least, and so I kind of like to write what I call thrillers with a heart, you know, where you at least care about these people and what happens to them. So I'm getting my
not life. Thrillers. So you don't mean thrillers ripping out a heart? You mean just
heart?
Okay,
with a heart and heart pounding, heart pounding, and
okay,
with a heart.
I gotcha. Okay,
ripping hearts out and eating them, right?
I kind of immediately went to My Bloody Valentine when you said that.
You're just warped. It's that simple.
I'm not going to eat my dinner now. Thanks, guys.
I already ate my dinner.
Everybody.
I was smart. Well, I'll tell you, Kevin, I got to tell you what, we even ran over because we just had so much fun. We just kept going. But we want to thank you
thank
so
you,
much.
Gosh, Rose going to be ticked
because
off.
this has been fabulous, yeah.
Oh,
and,
well, I had a great time with you guys. You're the best.
And just so everybody knows, too, you can find Kevin at KevinO'BrienBooks.com. And, yes, the picture on there is a little younger than how he looks now, but he's a damn fine-looking man.
Yeah.
But it's KevinO'BrienBooks.com is where you can find out more information about all the stuff that he's got going on.
And you got to read his stuff.
Oh. Yes. Yep. If you haven't read it, then you're just a moron, and that's your middle name. So that's what I would say.
Don't mince words. Okay.
I don't mince words. I mean, if you haven't read, I mean, if you're a thriller reader and you love the suspense and the horror, then can Kevin's not in your bookshelf, then you're just a fucking moron. That's all I got to say. I mean, I just say how it is. I really
just
don't
saying,
care.
Just saying.
I mean, it is. I'm just saying. That's just the way you have to do it.
The last broadcast of...
No. There's a reason why we bring authors on the show. It's because you guys are at the top of your game. It's the people that people should be reading. This is why. Because people want to know how to write. They need to read. And if you don't read, then you cannot write. And by reading authors like yourself, and we've had Jeffrey Deaver and Nelson DeMille and other authors on, I mean... We got it right here for you, so there's no excuses for people to say, I don't know what to read. Yeah, well, guess what? He's got like 14 books. There you go. Have fun. Go to the freaking beach now. I don't understand the problem.
He calls it as he sees it. I love it. Well, thank you, guys. You are the best.
Okay.
You are just the best.
All right, man. You have a good one, and we will talk with you soon.
Okay.
Thanks
thank
for
you
doing
guys,
it.
And thanks for being on the cover. Take care.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Right, bye-bye. And so speaking of sponsors, I would like to say that Beyond the Show, or Beyond the Cover in Suspense Radio this month, is brought to you by New American Library, publisher of Somebody I Used to Know,
the latest thriller from best-selling author David Bell, who Nelson DeMille praises as a natural storyteller and superb writer. And Suspense Magazine calls one of the brightest and best crime writers, crime fiction writers of our time. So discover David Bell, Somebody I Used to Know, on sale now wherever books are sold. Go check it out. Another author that should be on the reading list that you need to read if you want to be a writer. And it's just plain and simple how it goes. That's just the way I see it. I don't know how you see it, Jeff, but that's how I see it. You ready for Scott Turow? Because we have run out of time. We've got 13 minutes and 20 seconds of the Scott Turow interview. So everybody, this is from Thriller Fest. Here you go.
So Jeff and I are sitting down here at Thriller Fest again, and we are with best-selling author Scott Turow. So Scott, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Thank you for inviting me. I'm doing very well. Thanks.
We appreciate
it. Good night's sleep, which was a little unusual this week, so it was particularly great.
And this is the 10th anniversary of Thriller Fest, and you are passing the torch this year because you were the 2014 Thriller Master, and now this year you're passing the torch on. And so what does Thriller Fest mean to you, and what can a new author kind of expect when they're kind of coming into an event like this and seeing all of the big-name authors and everybody that they read?
Well, I think Thriller Fest is wonderful for a lot of different reasons. But I have tried to be in gratitude for, you know, the blessed career I've had, an advocate for authors. And I don't know of another conference of authors that does as much, frankly, for new authors and aspiring authors as Thriller Fest does. It teaches craft. It helps people with the business of publishing, understanding it, connecting people to each other, and the number of success stories that come out of Thriller Fest, I think, is unrivaled. Mm-hmm. So I love it at that level because of what it does for new and younger writers. And of course, you know, for me as last year's Thriller Master, it's because it's such a successful organization, particularly meaningful to be honored by my peers. So I'm delighted this year to be handing the award to the wonderful Nelson DeMille, right, whom I've known for many years, and not well, but whose work I've always loved. So it's a great occasion for me. I'm happy to be here.
Same publisher as well, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, we share a publisher, and I met Nelson, I think. Well, I've always been, an author published by what was formerly Time Warner. So,
okay.
So we've always shared a publisher, but at one point they were my paperback publisher only. And, you know, now in this era, they publish me in, you know, both paper and hard. And,
right, know, all over now.
Digital.
Every other format they have.
I'm kind of curious because you're one of those authors that sort of breaks the mold of what they tell beginning writers as well as established writers. You don't do the book a year sort of thing.
I don't. And that's probably been to my detriment in terms of commerce. And I don't care.
I love it.
That is something that somebody who's been very, very lucky can say, I don't care. For somebody who's trying to break in and get a name, you know, become, in that term I hate, a brand. But meaning that someone whose work is known to readers, you know, you don't have the luxury of saying, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to publish a book a year. But, you know, I've continued to practice law. I've been active in different kinds of advocacy. I was the chairman of the Ethics Commission, mm-hmm, in Illinois. I've been president of the Authors Guild. So, you know, I want to do a variety of other things in my life, and, you know, I don't write well if I'm writing really fast. And I've done it on occasion, and, you know, I'm sure the person who most notices the difference is me, but, you know, it's such a dream come true for me to have an audience that I don't want to be publishing books where I look back and feel like slitting my throat. So, I my publishers have tolerated my schedule, and it's worked out for all of us. So, you know, lucky me.
Well, I was going to say, because I know that you're not doing the writing fast and getting them out, I know that I'm going to get a quality book from you when it does come. And
well,
I'm always excited
about
it.
Yeah, and that's the good thing. You're just not throwing them out there and saying, oh, here's a book, and here's a book, and here's a book. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I like, who knows, you know? You like, yeah, you like to think that by taking your time, you know, you don't have some of the major faults that you recognize when you pick up books by other authors whose work you like generally, and you go, but oh my God, you know, how could we have that ending, or how could that character just drop off the map, or you know, something like that. So, but you know, like I said, sometimes it's an illusion, and you know, I always go back to the fact that one of the first moments that I knew I was a writer, I was in college and wrote one of the first short stories I ever published, but I wrote it in, I literally got up out of a fever bed and wrote it in 14 hours of continuous writing. And, you know, it was good. I knew it was good. It was the first time I really felt like I was summoning myself. Point being that writing fast does not mean writing badly, and I'm not trying to knock people who do, who are able to, you know, pull a book out of themselves on a faster schedule than I can.
Well, I have to ask, because I'm a fan, obviously. One of my favorite books of yours is 1L.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
it's a book that I'd never imagined reading, but because you wrote it, I thought, okay, I'll give it a try. And I was just, it was amazing.
Yeah, well, the 1L has a very amusing provenance, which is that, you know, I was a writer first. I was a writing fellow and teacher at Stanford. And didn't want to continue a career as an English professor. So, obviously, my literary career was not such that that was going to support me. And I began to notice that I was really, really, really interested in the law. My friends had become lawyers. I loved what they were doing. I was asking them questions about it. The new friends I was making were lawyers. And so I made this decision to go to law school, but I was kind of embarrassed about telling my agent, who'd been trying to sell the unpublished novel, as it turned out, that I'd written while in my years at Stanford. So in the course of writing her this letter explaining that I was going to law school, I said, you know, and by the way, I can't find a good book written from the perspective of a law student, and, you know, about what it's like to be a law student every day. And I really was not proposing that I write the book, but she didn't notice that and sent me back a contract. So I figured, well, hell, you know, I can paper the walls with rejection slips. I'll sign the contract and go to law school, and it all worked out. I mean, law school was a very intense experience for me. I was lucky enough at that point to have had a background as a writer, so I could get some of that intensity on the page. And, you know, and that's part of what, remarkably, has kept 1L in print since 1977.
Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And now, early on, of course, Presumed Innocent is the, you know, I mean, that's
right.
I mean, that's the mega breakout book. And when that kind of comes out and then it gets so successful and you have that kind of success, how much pressure did you feel afterwards to kind of maybe keep that level? Or did you have any of that pressure, you know, after that success?
Well, there are two ways to, you know, regard that kind of struck by lightning experience. And one is to say, you know, this is really neat, and people know who I am all of a sudden when I walk down the street, and there's my name at the top of the bestseller list, and I never dreamed of that, and I want to do it again. Or you can say, wow, what an amazing opportunity I've gotten. Now I can shape my life according to my own desires. So I made what people regarded as an incredible decision to continue to practice law, because I'd taken my own measure well. I like being a lawyer. I decided I would not, you know, rush out another book. I would not write a Rusty Savage sequel.
Mm-hmm.
I would write the book I intended to write, which was about Rusty's defense lawyer, Sandy Stern. And, you know, and I made all of those decisions to sort of march to my own drummer. And because I had the opportunity that Presumed Innocent had presented to me. And, you know, sort of like if your dream comes true, why not have all of it?
Right.
And, you know, and it's worked. It's worked. Yeah. You know, Presumed Innocent obviously changed my life. It was the right book at the right time. People were beginning to get enormously interested in law. There's stuff about, you know, the role of women and the role of men that's deeply embedded in the book. There are all kinds of things that worked. And, you know, turned it into the sensation that it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, gave me the independence that, as certainly as a writer and also as a lawyer, because I could look at my partners and say, well, I'll continue to practice, but, you know, I want to do the stuff that I want to do, which most of the time is meant pro bono work.
Nice.
Well, this is going to sound really strange. I've never thought I'd say this, especially to you, Scott, but Liz Berry wants me to come up and talk about our panel before we have our panel.
Okay.
So I've got to leave. I'll see you up there in a few minutes.
All right. Well,
it's a pleasure, and right. Look forward to seeing you in a few
good.
Minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, and we only have a couple minutes. Why don't we talk about what are you working on now? I mean, what are fans going to see from Scott Turow?
Well, sort of in line with what I was saying before about fulfilling my own curiosity.
Yeah.
I am working on a book about an American lawyer who sort of is at, you know, midlife crisis point. He's cut his ties with virtually everything and goes to The Hague to become a prosecutor at the International Criminal Court there.
Okay.
And he is brought on for diplomatic reasons because they need an American to investigate a massacre of 400 Roma during the end of the U.S. role in peacekeeping in Bosnia. So it's an old crime. It's 11 years old when the novel opens. And this guy is at sort of weird juncture in his life, but the investigation of the crime is still, despite the unusual setting, it's still the, you know, it's a suspense novel.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a really a whodunit. Who massacred these people? Because there are lots of different candidates in the Wild West of post-war Bosnia.
So you're going to leave us wait until the end to find out what's going on, right?
Oh, of course.
And that's the suspense, and that's where all the suspense mystery comes in. So last question: do you kind of, you know, when you receive a lot of email from fans and the things that they say, you know, what is kind of the one maybe common theme after a book has come out that you kind of see from the fans, and it gives you an idea of, wow, this is kind of what they're interested in?
That is true. I'm not sure it's the same with every book. My last book was about identical twins. And
right.
I got a lot of mail from twins and the parents of twins and the siblings of twins. So, you know, it varies. Obviously, you know, when somebody sits down and says, I've written read your books for years and thank you for having written them, they've given me a lot of pleasure. And I'm fortunate. I mean, I get the messages in that substance with some frequency. You know, I respond honestly and just say, you know, thank you, you've made my day.
That's great. Well, and we know you have to run, Scott, but, you know, just to have this couple minutes with you has just been such an honor, and we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been great, so thank you again so much. And, of course, I wasn't able to congratulate you last year, but congratulations on the 2014 Thriller Master Award.
Thanks.
You know, that's great. And passing it on to Nelson DeMille, here you go.
Which is something I'm looking forward to doing, so thank
you. All
right,
thanks so much.
Thanks,
so there we have it, Jeff. Another great interview, and people heard you happen to bolt in the middle. That was always kind of funny. I thought that was funny.
Well, he I had to prepare for the panel that he was about to go sit on. So, that was an interesting experience.
And you know, I was thinking of what the panel you did that you did should have been called, because instead of like the Thriller Master done, it should have said like the McDonald's sign, served over 1 billion books and counting. Because about who you had on there was about the sales probably for, I mean, I don't think Thriller Fest has ever had a panel that packed with that many great guests. So that was great.
Well, and when I was actually moderating it, watching
people, it was a packed house, and then watching people coming in as more and more people were laughing, and you could just see the energy in the room. Oh, it was an amazing experience, something I don't think I'll ever experience again, to be honest. It was great.
But you know what? You have that now, so that's good.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, everybody. Well, we'll be back maybe next week. We still got some more interviews to do for Thriller Fest. I know you're all anxiously waiting our reviews and the other things we got to talk about, but we still got some stuff that we have to do. We got, you know, change it up a little bit, get the format going. Want to thank Kevin again for being on, KevinO'BrienBooks.com. And the book is called No One Needs to Know. So you want to make sure you go check that out. And the other one that he has out right now is Tell Me You're Sorry is on sale on the Kindle for $2.99. You can go out and get that right now. So, Jeff, like always, my man, it's been wonderful. And we'll figure out the schedule when we're going to be on again. But make sure you check out SuspenseRadioNetwork.com for all that up-to-date information.
All right. Sounds good. And thanks again.
All right. Yeah. So until next time, everybody, we will see you all on the other side. And like we always say, if you're not listening to us, then you better keep reading. Have a good one later.
Have a good one.